Good morning, everyone. Nice group today. Okay, we're going to get started. Today we have Nassar Ali, who is a resident of Syracuse and the founder and executive director of the Seed Capital Fund of Central New York, which is a private LLC whose members are actively engaged in funding and supporting early stage tech companies. He is the managing director of the Start Fast Venture Accelerator, a key UVC initiative. Prior to the founding UVC, Ali was the president of the Tech Garden, which I just learned this morning, with the mission of creating an entrepreneurial culture in Syracuse and the Central New York region. In addition to managing the Syracuse Tech Garden, Ali manages the statewide network of experienced mentors. In 2008, Ali co-taught a course in technology entrepreneurship at SU, which has since grown into a year-long community campus collaborative effort known as the Syracuse Student Startup Accelerator. And he and I were chatting earlier this morning, and he moved here from Washington, D.C., and he was an associate there, Booz Allen Hamilton, and he was charged with helping the IRS commissioners manage over $1 billion in technology modernization and workforce restructuring. He received a MBA in finance and operations management from Yale's University School of Management and graduated from Princeton University with a degree in physics and a concentration in economics. Please join me in welcoming Nassar Ali.
Great to see so many friends in the audience. It's been a while since I was here last, and thank you all for inviting me. I hope that I can take you through a little bit of a tour of what is happening in Syracuse and around the upstate region. But my goal in being here today is to see how we can engage TMR in the conversation that is now going on, and also use the networks that you have as a way to enlarge and grow that conversation, because what we're talking about is really the future of these communities, and the only way that change will happen is if we have more and more people that are getting it and getting engaged and looking for opportunities to pull in those that are closest to them, even if they happen to be, you know, in places outside upstate New York. So when I moved up to Syracuse, next month is going to be 12 years, hard to believe, but it's been a great 12 years. When I moved up to Syracuse, the Chamber of Commerce offered me a position, and I spoke to a number of the businesses there, and they said, look, the problem that we have is that the core chamber membership is really made up of people who provide services to other businesses. And what we're looking at is Carrier and GM and all of these big businesses that used to be our customers, essentially either downsizing or moving away. And when we look, we don't see a pipeline of future businesses coming up. And we recognize that we can keep playing the game of economic development, which means trying to find some large employer to come in, but we need to have a pipeline. It can't just be we could win this one or we could win that one. It's not going to be enough to support us all. And so what they charged me with and then began to support me in is this search to figure out how we can once again grow new businesses. And this was back in 2004, and they'd already been working on it in 2002. And to give you a sense of how prescient they were in their understanding of where the future is and how it's evolving. In 2009, the Kauffman Foundation came out with a report. I promise you this is the only slide that I'll have with so many words on it, and so I'll read it out to you. So these are 2009 and 2010. The Kauffman Foundation came out with some very interesting findings around entrepreneurship. The first interesting thing was that early stage companies create most of the jobs. They were looking at census data across the U.S., and they were looking at it over, I think, like a 15-year period. And Nearly all net job creation since 1980, they found, has occurred in firms less than 5 years old. That means these are not the biggest employers in town. They are becoming the biggest employers in town. And if you don't have them at the earlier stage, you miss out on that opportunity. Furthermore, they found that when you exclude the jobs from new firms, the net employment growth rate is negative. And this is where you are seeing the end of the Industrial Revolution and the rise of the information age and the rise of automation and so on. Because as these, the more mature companies still have to make money, still have to make profits, but for them, the way to do that is not growing headcount. It is to look for efficiencies. And that was true across the board, except for the younger firms. Then the second thing, which was sort of embedded in it, is that of all the new companies, because you could start, you know, a Verizon cell phone reseller or another photocopy shop or any kind of retail. They said of all the new companies that are started, high growth companies account for a disproportionate share of job creation. And the top 1% of young firms generate 40% of new jobs. So there is this clear delineation which says age is not the only factor. It's also the kind of business that you should be focused on that is going to deliver the returns. And it's a very specific subset, you know? And that is sort of one of the seminal findings. And of course, they're looking back to 1980. And we were thinking about this in the early 2000s in this community. And I was very fortunate that, you know, with the support of all the business community and the chamber members, we were able to launch the Tech Garden. Then we were able to put together a number of different programs. But this was, you know, 5 years in, I was like, wow, we were on the right track. And what is the track? As I said earlier, this was sort of, this is the big challenge that we all face, right? We can all recognize all of those logos. And when we look at them, probably Paytech and Paychex were probably the youngest companies in that group. And they were founded in the, you know, over 20 years ago. So the challenge for us as a region is, what is the future? How do we get to the next generation of companies that are going to replace those icons that essentially transformed our communities and transformed our cityscapes and built our reputation around the world? And that's sort of the holy grail, so to speak. Now, when we started looking into this, I said, okay, it can't be that, you know, the last time somebody came up with a great idea for a great company was in the 1990s. And so we started to look around and see which are the companies that are in the news, that are making waves all around the country. And what we found was that this is a ridiculously small proportion of those companies, but a staggering number of those companies have founders who came from our region. Many of them grew up here, you know, like the guy, one of the founders of Airbnb is from Albany. Others went to school here, like Andy Rubin, who started Android, which is probably the phone that two-thirds of the world has in their pockets, went to Utica College when it was part of SU in the 80s. So there's the ability that we have to come up with creative people, the best people, come up with new ideas has really been undiminished. What's really been happening over this time is that somehow all of these people have been taking those ideas and, you know, making them happen in other parts of the country. And that was sort of this insight that was really staggering, because I was like, okay, if we need them to help us, they're just a phone call away. We can figure out how to build those relationships. You know, Priceline is another example. Almost everyone went to Cornell. And then we had Jeff Hoffman come here last fall, and he's from Williamsville, New York. So, you know, he grew up here as well. So it was interesting because, you know, I'm having a lot of discussions with people during this period of time. And, you know, the list of reasons, when I posed them a question, why are they not here? The list of reasons was all too familiar, you know. I don't need to even read these. You'll recognize them. And so one of the things that I do is I don't believe easily. I need data. And so I said, well, if all of those people who are building all of these companies actually at some point made the move, why don't we ask them why they moved instead of what we believe is the reason? And it was fascinating. You know, no one mentioned any of those things as a reason. But what every single person said was, I did not know anyone in upstate New York who had started a business and could help me. It was staggering. It was like across the board. And then they would go into their personal story of how they left the region. They graduated. Their girlfriend got into grad school, so they moved to Boston. They, you know, a friend invited them to San Francisco or, you know, whatever. And then you insert the name of whatever big city they ended up in. And the next thing they would say was, I met so-and-so, they connected me with so-and-so, they connected me with so-and-so, and before I knew it, I was with my tribe, you know? And the constant message that they got back from the local communities was either, hey, nobody here has started a company because we've just been working for the same company for 30 years, you know? If you're a smart kid, why don't you just stick to your knitting and work your way up with IBM or GE or Kodak or, you know, Xerox or Carrier or whatever? That was the message that the communities were sending to the best and brightest among us, the people who are capable of inventing the future. And it was very different from the message that they got when they moved to these other communities. So this openness, this connectivity, this sense of, okay, I may not know anything about this, but let me see if I can put you in touch with someone who can, this came out again and again as a major factor. So then a few years later, a friend of ours, Victor Wang, who's a venture capitalist, came out with this book, and I encourage all of you to take a look at it. It's probably the best articulation of the kind of communities where innovation and new company formation thrives that I have ever come across, and that made the most sense to me. Because what Victor talks about is the fact that, you know, we're living in a world where anyone can have an idea, but transforming that idea into a company, a successful one, requires putting a lot of different resources together, which are all spread out, so you have to have a lot of connectivity. But most importantly, what he talks about is this notion of the rainforest versus industrial agriculture. And the analogy that he uses that really fits, you know, the environment that we see here versus what we see in, you know, other communities, whether it's Boston or whether it is San Francisco or Austin, Texas, or Boulder, Colorado, or New York City, or Washington, D.C., you think about it, is that there is a lot more tolerance for weeds, you know, is how he puts it. Because he says, when someone's starting something, it's messy, it doesn't fit anyone's model, it's kind of crazy. Think about Facebook. Oh, yet another way for college kids to waste their time. You know, think about Priceline. What do you mean I'm going to pay you and not know what flight I'm on? You know, think about these things. They're all counterintuitive. They don't fit into any business model or process or understanding. They can't possibly survive in big companies whose simple message is, we got to build more and more of this stuff, more faster and cheaper, and ship it out there because this is how we make money. And communities that are organized around thinking that sort of model of operations needs to be where everybody fits in, everyone's understands what the process is, everything, tend to be forbidding and closed to people who are innovating. Because those people don't know what they need. They may need this tool today and they may need that person tomorrow. And the ability for them to find those people and connect with them is really important. So the rainforest is kind of where all these herbal medicines and all these new innovations and stuff come out, because you know what you're planting when you're planting a field of corn. And anything that looks like a weed, you're going to pull out because it messes with your efficiency. It messes up your product. In a rainforest, all of this, everything goes. You don't know whether that the next plant could turn out to be a lifesaver or not. And I think that's sort of, you know, a big analogy. But what it also talks about is how behaviors need to change and how you need to, you know, really create the conditions where more and more people feel comfortable thinking that they can have the connections and they can make the change that they want in this community. So that is really why I titled this talk Weeds in the Rainforest, because if we're going to be successful, we really have to figure out how to make that happen. And all of us have to be part of that rainforest. And we have to be looking out for those weeds. And we have to be figuring out how to connect with them and how to help them out and how to help them go to the next level. So I'm going to go through the next few slides pretty quickly because I'd love to get your thoughts and comments. But what I wanted to do was to talk about what we've been doing in Syracuse and how over the last 6 years we've been applying a lot of those lessons to other upstate communities. So in 2007, a group of us, about 42 of us actually, got together. And we started something called the Seed Capital Fund. And the idea was very simple. You know, all of us have some financial capability. None of us are rich enough to launch our own venture fund and put millions aside. But could we do something that became the first stepping stone for innovators coming out of our colleges and universities? And all 42 of us put in about, you know, $40,000 into a bank account and said, let's start finding these innovators and starting to work with them. And as an example, we're now 8 years later, we ended up making 7 investments in different university technologies because we knew that those would take a lot of money and we needed to have follow-on capital. So we've put in probably about $4 or $5 million into those companies. 2 of them have succeeded, 2 of them are going to succeed wildly, and I think 3 of them are gonna fail. But the net effect is that those 7 companies have raised 90 million plus so far in the last 9 years. And that's a significant portion of all the venture capital happening in upstate New York. And again, if in some cases we were the fools who walked in before the real money came in, but we benefited from supporting them at the early stage and our communities benefit from that. But it took a risk. And we said, look, if you're worried about losing the money, don't put it in. Think of it as, you know, something you're doing to help, because if it makes the difference between you being able to retire or not, don't do this. If it makes the difference between your kids going to college or not, this is not the best use of that money. That needs to be protected. This is something that you're trying to give back, and if it works, great. If it doesn't work, you know, we'll just be totally upfront. So then a year or two later, we realized that we're not seeing enough local activity. And so a group of us got together at the Tech Garden. That's John Liddy, Liz Liddy's son, and Mike Deredita, Sean Brannigan, whom you may know, Paul Brooks, and myself. And we were at the Tech Garden, and we said, we have this empty space. And what we're finding is that more and more of these companies that are started are graduates of our universities. So how about we look for the most entrepreneurial ones and give them the opportunity to spend the summer, which is really the nicest time in some ways to be here, spend the summer in the community working on their project and get the local business community to come help them. And this was, you know, a very novel concept at the time because, you know, and we were really fortunate to have the support of the university, particularly Liz Liddy, who figured out how to make it work for the students and for the community. And John agreed to, he had just left a position, I was desperate to find the right leader, and he was the perfect person for this. And so the first year that we started, those are all the little plaques on the wall in the Tech Garden, is 2009. There were 5 companies that came in. One of them ended up on Shark Tank a year ago and turned down a $2 million investment offer because they'd already raised more money, you know? And then the next year, it doubled. Then the next year it doubled again. The next year it doubled again. The next year it doubled again. And what we found is that there's like this insatiable appetite. And the number of people that were willing to help as mentors the first year was literally four. And I think those four were listed in those pictures I shared with you. In 2 years, we had 100 mentors who were working with these teams. And we actually had to figure out how to cut back the number of teams we were taking in, because we figured, you know, you can't really help 50 teams at a time. So you become more selective. But it tells you the level of innovation and the level of ambition and the level of creativity. And these teams were coming from everywhere. The best ones were coming from arts and design, not computer science and business. And there was a very clear reason for it. Computer science and business are very much structured as this is what you need to learn to get ahead. Arts, whether it's architecture, whether it's design, whether it's, that's where you learn how to problem solve. That's where you say, okay, I need to understand there is a process, but it's not a process that's a cookie cutter process each time, because in the case of that process of creativity, you're actually looking for a different outcome each time, not the same widget popping out at the end of the process. You know, so it's a very different way of thinking about it, but we're surrounded by, you know, the people who are building, going to be building the future. And this was our way to really begin to tap into it. So then we sort of said, okay, let's take the next step. And in 2012, we said, we know so many people. In 2012, we said, we're building this global network because we now know all these alumni. We now have all these capabilities, and we're becoming a little more sophisticated as investors. What can we do to see if we can change the game a little bit more? So instead of saying, okay, we're going to look for students and help them and so on, what if we tried to find the best teams that were out there and invite them up to come and work with us in more of a boot camp kind of session? So we started this program called Start Fast. And so Start Fast is an accelerator. So that's me in the front, and to my left is Chuck Storman. Chuck is another sort of classic of Upstate in that he has lived here his whole life, grew up in Niagara Falls, came to SU, started his first company while a master's student, and then has had four successful exits, you know, built companies. Some of them are still here in town, some of them are overseas, but nobody knew nobody the entire time he was here, until he heard about the seed fund, and then we started to meet, and we figured out we really loved doing what we're doing. So he said, well, why don't we start working with these teams together? So what's interesting is that the rest of the group that is around us, this is, I think, the class of 2013 summer. So there are people there who came to Syracuse from Canada, from Chile, from Australia, from India, and then we have a whole bunch of college interns from Cornell, from RIT, from Syracuse, from Lemoyne, and so on, you know? And all of these teams found us on the internet, liked the fact that we had these incredible mentors that we could connect them with, people who had built significant businesses, not necessarily in Syracuse, but across Upstate and around the country. We became their conduit to success, and they are coming. So each year, since 2012, we've been looking at over 1,000 companies and picking the 5 to 7 we really want to work with. And this year, we're talking to companies from Spain. We're talking to companies from Prince Edward Island. You know, who knew entrepreneurs lived there? But funnily enough, they moved there from Ireland. You know, so it's truly a global phenomenon. And what we're doing is we're pulling these people in, because when you recognize that every entrepreneur is looking for success and you give them a path to success, they really don't care where it takes them. That's all they want. You know, so they don't really worry about the winters or the taxation or anything else. That what they are driven by is, can you help me succeed? And that's a big part of what this is all about. So, you know, 4 years, 24 teams, four continents. And in 2009, after I'd been at the Tech Garden for 5 years, sort of in some ways there was this major shift for me because one of the events I was hosting, my friend, now my dearest friend and partner, Martin Babinek, walked in the door. So Martin is another upstate classic story. Grew up in Little Falls, town of 5,000 people, pumped gas at the Thruway gas station while working his way through community college, went on to finish his bachelor's degree, and then, like so many others, left the region. Traveled the world, ended up in Silicon Valley, started a company in 1988 called TriNet. Fast forward to 2016, TriNet is traded on the New York Stock Exchange and is one of the most successful companies out there in the country, a true pioneer. He was talking about how to automate and support human resources before the internet was born. That's how, and he, as he's the first to admit, he would never have succeeded if he tried to convince anyone outside Silicon Valley that such a thing could even be possible, right? So, but here's the thing. In 1999, he moved his family back to Little Falls, and he's lived there since 1999. And he spent 10 years getting his company to the point where it was, you know, a part of the national infrastructure of venture capital-backed companies and other companies. And the reason that he brought his family back was because he and his wife wanted their kids to be growing up surrounded by their family. You know, and he spent 10 years commuting between the world of upstate and Silicon Valley and upstate and Boulder and upstate and Boston. And we spent a year talking to each other because he said, look, I'm gonna step down from running TriNet. I've already got my CEO picked. I've already got my chairman successor picked. And I wanna figure out what we wanna do next. And by that time, I was like, there were two things that were happening because one, we had these successes that were happening in Syracuse, but the other thing was, as I was traveling to other communities, I realized that, you know, Syracuse needs more critical mass to have more diversity, more connections, but that these other communities also have similar challenges. So after a year of talking, we decided to launch Upstate Venture Connect, which is a 501c3 not-for-profit. And what we wanted to do was to build that rainforest because we realized it couldn't just be Syracuse. It needs to include Ithaca. It needs to include Rochester and Buffalo and points in between and all the way up to Potsdam and Clarkson and, you know, down to the Hudson Valley. Because it's, we all share a lot in common, you know. There is so much going on that the only way to build that rainforest is to make a really connected network where everything comes together. This is just one example. So if you look at what differentiates our region from almost every other place in the country. We have 110 schools of higher education, and we have, you know, 500,000 college students that come here from all over the world to get the best education possible. But each of them is in this little pipeline silo where they come in, they get their degree, and they move out. You know, they don't connect with anything off campus, and there is sometimes not even enough collaboration on campus for them to connect with other people that they might need to diversify. You know, so this is the kind of thing where, you know, having a student sandbox, having more engagement with the community, having a local angel fund, having those things, and then having those people connected to each other. Because you know what, when I graduate from Cornell, I'm not no longer just interested in Ithaca or Cornell. They're dear to my heart, but what I'm looking at is where's the best opportunity? Because I want to figure out how to stay ahead of the curve. And so that, but there's no way for Cornell or any other school to really feel like it's in their interest to facilitate that opportunity. But our communities can do that. And that's a big part of what we've been talking about and doing. So we, you know, it's not Martin and I alone. The first thing we had to do was we had to find people who were thinking like us and who could help us out. I want to introduce everyone to Catherine Cartini, who's been working with us for the last 2 years because she's behind a lot of the magic that is happening here. Catherine, again, is a local. She grew up in Fayetteville, and then she went to SU, and then, like so many others, she went to see the broader world, and now she's back, and we're thrilled to have her working with us on all of our communications and outreach and so on. But there's lots of other people in other parts of the state who are also now helping us get the word out and get connected and so on. This is a group we created 2 years ago called the UNY50, and everybody in this group sort of has two things in common. One is that they've all sort of experienced the ups and downs of building something and failing and then succeeding. And the second thing is they all want to figure out a way to help their communities. So this is a group we call the UNY50, and all they're doing is they're simply saying, I'm here, I'm available. If somebody needs help and you connect me with them, I'll help. If something needs to be done in my community and I have the resources to do it, I'm willing to step forward and help create that angel fund, help create that student engagement, help create those opportunities for people who want to move back. So this is kind of, you know, just a quick snapshot. I'm going to go through these very quickly, but in 2010, we just had the sandbox. As we looked at it at the end of last year, there's a ton more. But as you can see, there's like almost 100 more sandboxes that you have the opportunity to create in upstate alone, right? Who are the people that want to do that? Who are the people that want to step up to that? That's part of the connection that we need to build. Next, please. Angel funds. We had the seed capital fund only out there in 2010 when UVC was launched. But since then, there are all these other funds that are happening. So now we've gone from 40 people in one community to probably 250 people across 5 or 6 communities. And some of them are on their second and third funds. You know, so again, it's a way to scale, but it's a way to scale something where you're kind of close to the ground and you're working with entrepreneurs and helping them in your community. Startup accelerators, we didn't have any. And then in 2012, we launched StartFast. And since then, you know, there are many others that have started, some that are supported by government, some that are private, and more that are coming along. But again, this is something, the marketplace is so big that there is no way that just these alone can exhaust everything that's out there. And then as we've been doing this, and those, you can see the bump that's happened at the end, that's thanks to Catherine, because she finally explained to us how the internet worked. You know, and we said, wow, you mean if we do some stuff, more people will find us on the internet? And she said, yeah, and I can help you do that. And we said, hired. So that's an example of how our reach is growing. But again, there's only so much you can do online. You know, there's a lot more conversations that need to happen. And that's a big part of what we're trying to trigger. So that's my talk. I, you know, if I have a request, it is, you can just click through like 3 or 4 times, you know, and we'll get to the end of this. But the idea is, you know, each of us has the capacity to act as a connector, even if it is to our nieces and nephews or children or grandchildren who are doing amazing things, but maybe not in upstate. They may be in New York City, they may be in other places. If you can just begin to have that conversation to make them aware that there's a lot more interesting stuff happening, they don't have to move, but they can still help the community because their networks, their connections, their interests, you know, help. And that makes us all stronger. If you have the capacity and are interested in angel investing, there are a ton of really interesting companies all around, and I would be very happy to introduce you to them. And, you know, UVC is donor supported, so if you get a chance, please visit our website and help us out in any way you can. So thank you very much.
It occurred to me when you're talking about connectors that a campaign might be get to know your grandchildren, bring your children back to Syracuse, that what you're really doing is targeting people who have children who are doing these things, and this is a wonderful place to live, and people want to come back, as you said, and be with families.
Yeah.
So I think a campaign really targeted at that age group, you know, the 50, 60, 70, 80 age group who wants to their grandchildren to grow up here.
Yeah, there's so much happening. You know, so Jeff is here, and Jeff's son is one of the senior people at Apple, and he's looking to come back. Jeff, do you want to say a few words about kind of what his thinking was?
Thank you. His name's Garrett, and he served in the Navy for 5 years, and a week after he got out, he was hired by Apple, and he had some progressively interesting positions, most recently in operations. We didn't know what he did for 3 years. He was going to China about 130 days a year, and he ended up being on the team that created the Apple Watch. I have one of the first ones. Mm-hmm. But he got interested. His roots were here. He found his friend. He lives in San Francisco, where he's been for the last 8 years. And he was interested in having a lot of his friends here and finding they stayed here, wanting to connect with them, and finding out about people like Nasir, who I guided him to when he was interested, and others. And about 2 months ago at the most, he left Apple, and he went with a company called Density. And I'll let Nasir tell you about that. They spend some time, they have people here in Syracuse, I believe down at the Tech Garden.
Yes.
And they also have a core team because of some of their investors out in the Silicon Valley. And I can't even explain their idea. Perhaps Nasir can. He hopes to get back here eventually. He loves upstate New York. He loves the snow, loves the weather. Bought a house, has a place up in Thousand Islands. And so he's really reconnected here. I guess that's the long story.
So Density is another example of a company that came out of the student sandbox. And Andrew Farah was an English major at SU who fell in love with coding, started to teach himself to program. Then he went through the sandbox, decided that he and his girlfriend, now his wife, wanted to stay in Syracuse after graduation. By the way, the retention rate for the kids who come through the sandbox is 60% of them decide to stay in Syracuse after graduation, you know? And none of these kids are from here. But every single one of them said, hey, I have a network now, and if we graduate and my partners and I need to move, we'll have to rebuild everything from scratch. So they were here. Their team is still here. A couple of them moved out to the West Coast. And Density, very simply, is building a tool that allows people in shops and malls and other public places to measure the amount of traffic that they have in and out of the store, and then to use those metrics as a way to attract more people, guide them towards new offerings, and so on. And they'll do a lot more. So.
Hi, that was a great presentation. It's great to see someone study a problem and understand what it means and actually come up with the solution to the problem. That seems hard to do sometimes for some reason. But I thought the job trends slide, mm-hmm. and then your reference to the rainforest and those ideas the whole time you were talking brought me back to my high school senior at Nottingham High School and his friends who are all thinking about the future. They're going to college. They're picking majors. And I guess I just felt like there's a way to reframe what you talked about. You know, while they're thinking about their futures, at the same time, they can't really forecast what the future means. Mm-hmm. And you presented information that helps all of us understand that. And I keep thinking there must be a way to reframe that to my son and his friends, mm-hmm. So they could kind of rethink what their possibilities are for jobs.
Yeah.
And have you done that? Mm-hmm. And do you think that's true?
So the answer is yes, but a lot more needs to be done, right? There is an event at Lemoyne College on the 27th about careers in STEM, and I'm one of the panelists there. I'd be happy to give you more information about it. I think it's open to the public, so everyone is welcome. There is this huge gap in our understanding about the future. All we know is that it'll be different, right? And the problem that we have is that public policy and institutions are way behind the curve, where we're still trying to teach people and to program them on educational paths that made sense for the industrial age. But in a sort of more, you know, chaotic or more creative collision-driven world that we're all entering into, the opportunities are different. I mean, when I graduated from college, I could go work any place, and I knew that while college taught me what kind of person I wanted to be and taught me how to learn, it didn't prepare me for a career, but I could count on whoever I went to work with, work for, providing that training. Very, very, very few employers today offer that, you know? And at the same time, where you leave college, the whole notion is I'm preparing you to get to the next level of education, but there is this gap because not all of us want to go get our master's and PhDs. I mean, it makes sense if you're going into a professional career, whether, you know, you need to be certified as an engineer, you need to go through the training to be a doctor or a lawyer and so on, but for the vast majority of people, they're kind of left hanging without, you know, the skill sets or the infrastructure. And the worst part of it is that you have tens or if not hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt. So the government in some ways has made it easier for people to become indentured servants because you can't even declare personal bankruptcy to get out of your student loans, you know? So there's a lot of you know, cross currents in here, but there's this big gap. And the New York Times actually had a really good article last week that I shared with some friends about how people come out of college, and 10 million of them are still living with their parents, you know? And anyone that has more than $10,000 of debt is entirely unlikely to decide to become an entrepreneur because of the amount of pressure that they're under, you know? And so they're looking for jobs, but they're not prepared for the jobs that are out there. There's going to be a 10 million person gap over the next 10 years in terms of the number of people with the ability to program, because believe it or not, there are more computers on the planet than people now, you know? And you have to figure out how to speak to them. It was all about, hey, you gotta learn Chinese. Now, if you can't learn how to code, you don't stand a chance at controlling your career because you're at the whim of somebody else. So there's a lot of very interesting things that are going on, and I think students need to find a way to navigate that.
Hi. Detroit has its own public issues, some of which are obviously a lot worse than ours, but their entrepreneurial scene is well known across the country. Mm-hmm. So what do you say that they have that we don't, and what can we learn from them?
So as someone who's actually familiar with the Detroit scene, I will tell you it's probably not that much bigger than what's happening here and in other places. The thing that gives Detroit that brand up there is not even cars anymore. You know, the guy who founded Quicken and Quicken Loans basically bought up half of, you know, all these abandoned buildings in downtown Detroit. And then he put a big sign on it and said, I'm moving all my people down here. And then he said, I'm going to put together a venture fund and we're going to start creating incubators so that more young people can come here. And that is what led to, you know, the press around that, the marketing around that, it was a stake in the ground. It wasn't the government's bailout. It wasn't GM. It wasn't Ford. It was one entrepreneur deciding that I'm going to do something about my hometown. Tony Hsieh is doing the same thing in Las Vegas. Mixed results, but for someone to say, I'm going to put $350 million of my own money into creating an entrepreneurial ecosystem, that's a huge statement. He's able to draw people from around the world to come. You know, there are other examples of that, and I think, you know, part of what we're doing with getting the UNY50 group together is to begin that kind of dialogue. But somebody has to, you know, step up, and then everybody else follows.
So it seems that you've had just continual success. I'm wondering if you had setbacks, what they were and what you learned from them.
Behind every one of those stories is sort of, when you're doing something entrepreneurial, the way we teach people is you say, you know, everybody looks at the success, but success, the process to get to success is failure, 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 success. You just have to keep trying different things. So I tell people, you know, in 2007, it took us 3 months to close the seed fund. And we had more people knocking on the door, and we just said, we can't take more people right now, right? But it took us 3 years before that to try and figure out, you know, who would be interested, where would the deals come from, what kinds of models are out there, what kinds of, you know, approaches could we take, and so on and so forth, as an example. The 24 companies that you saw that came out of StartFast, every year we whittle down over 1,000 to pick the 5 to 7 we like, and we're basically in love because we like them so much and we want them to succeed. But you know what? Half of them, we know, by the time 3 months are over, half of them are going to fail. And there are a few that will continue to kind of, you know, tread water, but then there'll be just a handful, just maybe one out of five that's going to go like a rocket ship. And that's the success that you're going to build on. But the thing to recognize is that you can't get to success if you don't take those risks. You have to be able to have a portfolio of programs and options and so on. Like, if there's only one place to get angel funding in town, then you're toast. Because if, who knows why somebody turned you down? Maybe they had a better deal somewhere else. But if that's your only option, you're going to want to move to some place where you have a lot more options. Because you just need to try and fail and try and fail until you succeed. So those are, failure is embedded in everything.
Thanks a lot for your exciting and interesting presentation, and it was fascinating to see your list of all the reasons people give for not coming here, or not why Central New York doesn't thrive, like the weather and, mm-hmm. and the state tax system and so forth. And I've done a little traveling, and I've become more and more impressed that Syracuse has a lot of assets mm-hmm. And is well connected in mm-hmm. in its region and, yeah. and outside the region. And I wanted to ask specifically about the state, the role of the state, and the perception. I mean, if you hear politicians or, mm-hmm. or public figures talk, it almost sounds like they're the ones who'll create the jobs and their policies and the state tax policies and the state climate will determine, the public policies will mm-hmm. determine the private sector's fate. And I haven't heard you really mention the state at all. And I wondered if the role of the state has changed, if it's shifting a little bit, and if we can believe any of the rhetoric about the state tax climate getting better and the state attitude toward entrepreneurship being better. And also the perception that New York City kind of sucks all the air out of the room for upstate. Does upstate have a better shot than it used to?
So I heard two different questions. The answer to the last question, does upstate have a better shot than it used to? I think is absolutely yes, but the only thing that ensures it is more public engagement and private participation. The first part of your question about the state is something that I've sort of looked at for a long time, and it was certainly part of what we looked at. And the thing is that it's really a mindset issue rather than a state policy issue. You know, the fact of the matter is that New York City has higher taxes than that we do in upstate. Energy costs are 2 times or more than they are in upstate New York. You know, housing is 5 times more than it is in upstate New York. You know, it doesn't matter to people when things are good. These are all problems when things are not working out. So my answer to do we pay a lot in taxes is yes, but only as a proportion of what our housing stock is worth. And what's driving that housing stock's price is not the cost of the inputs, it's what some other buyer is willing to pay. So if you look at the same house that I own in Washington, D.C., which was 80 years old, and falling apart on a lot that's one-tenth the size of what I have now, it was still worth twice as much, And as a proportion, even though I was paying city taxes, I wasn't paying that much more because my house was worth a lot more. You see what I'm saying? So it's all relative. We can't reduce the amount of snow that falls that needs to be cleared away. The only thing we can control is how do we get more people, create more demand, because that's what creates the rise. And I think the state issue, as I alluded to earlier, I think the public sector is driven by politicians' need to get reelected, which means that by definition, they have a time frame to show results that's 2 to 4 years max, And if you think about when the fundraising starts and when the reelection campaign starts and so on, it's actually half of that. The challenge that we have in terms of building these communities is that this is a generational game. We have 30, 40 years of not creating these startups, of not supporting them, of a brain drain and a demographic gap, When I go to Washington, D.C. or Boston or New York City, the biggest thing that I notice is that young people from all over the world are there. And when I come back here, the biggest thing I notice is that those young people aren't here, So we have a tremendous opportunity because up until the age of 22, they're all here, I couldn't make the same case for Indiana. And it's not a function of, what the state's policies are. I'm sure Indiana has less taxes, or a more liberal regulatory regime. But that's not the reason why people are leaving. They're leaving because they're finding opportunity, and we have to create that opportunity. So the government can affect the macro level, but what we're talking about is the micro level. And they have very limited ability to impact that. Because in this day and age, I can build my product and my service anywhere, and I can sell it anywhere, and I can be anywhere while doing it, right? That's the world we're living in. It's not really about, one of the most successful companies is a company that was 10 people strong, but they were in 7 different time zones. But they were all programmers, and they were used to working crazy hours. And so they basically said, all we're doing is building software, and all we need is the internet. And if we figure it out, then as long as, we can actually build software 24 hours a day as opposed to having to work in 8-hour shifts when all of us come together, right? So that's the world we're living in. That's why two guys in Czechoslovakia can launch Skype or something, and becomes a worldwide phenomenon. So
thank you so much. It was very informative.
Thank you very much.